medical school. Some, like the ergot Larch used to make the uterus contract after delivery, and pituitary extract, directly affected the uterus. Others ruined the intestines. They were simply drastic purgatives. Two of the cadavers Larch had worked with in medical school had been victims of a rather common household aborticide of the time, turpentine. People who didn't want babies in the 1880s and 1890s were also killing themselves with strychnine and oil of rue. The French lunar solution Mrs. Eames had tried was oil of tansy. She had taken it for such a long time, and in such amounts, that her intestines had lost their ability to absorb vitamin C. Thus did she turn herself into Munster. She died, as the pathologist had correctly observed, of scurvy. Mrs. Eames could have chosen several other ways of attempting to abort the birth of another child. There were stories that a rather notorious abortionist in the South End was also the district's most successful pimp. Because he charged nearly $500 for an abortion, which very few poor women could afford, in their indebtedness they became his whores. His quarters, and others like his, were called simply Off Harrison, appropriately vague but not without meaning. One of the facilities of the South Branch of the Boston Lying In was established on Harrison Street, so that Off Harrison, in street language, correctly implied something unofficial, not to mention illegal. It did not make much sense to have an abortion off Harrison, as Mrs. Eames perhaps had reason to know. Her daughter also knew the methods of that place, which was why she gave Wilbur Larch a chance to do the job, and gave herself a chance to have the job done well. "I said I ain't quick," Mrs. Eames's daughter told young Larch. "I'd be easy. I'd get out of here in just a couple of minutes." It was after midnight at the South Branch. The house officer was asleep. The nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist, was also asleep. The colleague who had woken Larch, he'd gone to sleep too. The dilation of the cervix at any stage of pregnancy usually leads to uterine contractions, which expel the contents of the uterus. Larch also knew that any irritant of the uterus would usually have the desired effect, contraction, expulsion. Young Wilbur Larch stared at Mrs. Eames's daughter. His legs felt rocky. Perhaps he was still standing with his hand on the back of Mrs. Eames's seat on that swaying train from Portland before he knew he had the clap. "You want an abortion," Wilbur Larch said softly. It was the first time he had spoken the word. Mrs. Eames's daughter took the seagull feather out of her pigtail and jabbed Larch in the chest with the quill end. "Shit or get off the pot," she said. It was with the words shit and pot that the sour stench of cigar reached him. Wilbur Larch could hear the nurse anesthesiologist sleeping. She had a sinus condition. For an abortion, he wouldn't need as much ether as he liked to use for a delivery. He would need only a little more than he routinely gave himself. He also doubted it was necessary to shave the patient. Patients were routinely shaved for a delivery, and Larch would have preferred it for an abortion, but to save time he could skip it. He would not skip ether. He would put red methylate on the vaginal area. If he'd had a childhood like Mrs. Eames's daughter, he wouldn't have wanted to bring a child into the world either. He would use the set of dilators with the Douglas points, rounded, snub-nosed points. They had the advantage of an easy introduction into the uterus and eliminated the danger of pinching tissue in withdrawal. With the cervix dilated to the desired size, he doubted that, unless Mrs. Eames's daughter was well along in her third or fourth month, he would need to use forceps, and then only for the removal of placenta and the larger pieces. A medical school textbook had referred, euphemistically, to the products of conception. These could be scraped from the wall of the uterus with a curette, perhaps with two different sized curettes, the small one to reach into the corners. But he was too young, Wilbur Larch. He hesitated. He was thinking about the time for recovery from ether that he would need to allow Mrs. Eames's daughter, and what he would say to his colleagues, or to the nurse if she woke up. Or even to the house officer, if it turned out to be necessary to keep the girl until the morning, if there was any excessive bleeding, for example. He was surprised by the sudden pain in his chest. Mrs. Eames's savage daughter was stabbing him with the seagull feather again. I ain't quick. I ain't quick, I said. The Eames girl screamed at him, stabbing him again and again, until the feather bent in her hand. She left it stuck in his shirt. In turning away from him, her heavy braid brushed his face. The braid's odor overwhelmingly conveyed smoke. When she was gone and Larch plucked the seagull feather from his breast, he noticed that the oil of tansy, the French lunar solution, had spilled on his hands. Its smell was not unpleasant, but it momentarily overpowered the smell Larch liked and was used to. It overpowered the ether. It put an end to his peace of mind. They did not use ether off Harrison. They didn't concern themselves with pain there. For pain off Harrison, they used music. An outfit called the German Choir practiced Lieder in the front rooms off Harrison. They sang passionately. Perhaps Mrs. Eames's daughter appreciated it, but she made no mention of the music when she was brought back to the South Branch a week later. No one was sure how she got there. She appeared to have been flung against the door. She also appeared to have been beaten about the face and neck, perhaps for failing to pay the usual abortion fee. She had a very high fever. Her swollen face was as hot and dry to the touch as bread fresh from the oven. From the fever and the tenseness of her abdomen, rigid as glass, the house officer and the night nurse suspected peritonitis. The reason they woke Wilbur was that Mrs. Eames's daughter had a piece of paper pinned to the shoulder of her dress. Dr. Larch, shit or get off the pot. Pinned to her other shoulder, like a mismatched epaulette pulling her dress askew, was a pair of ladies' underwear. They were her only pair. It was discovered she wasn't wearing any. Apparently her panties had been pinned there in a hurry. That way they wouldn't be lost. Wilbur Larch didn't need to examine Mrs. Eames's daughter very thoroughly in order to discover that the abortion attempt had failed. A fetus with no heartbeat was imprisoned in her uterus, which had suffered some haywire contraction and was in a state of spasm. The hemorrhage and infection could have come from any of the several methods employed off Harrison. There was the water cure school, which advocated the use of an intrauterine tube and syringe, but neither the tube nor the water was sterile, and the syringe had many other uses. There was a primitive suction system, simply an airtight cup from which all the air could be sucked by a foot-operated pump. It had the power to abort, but it also had the power to draw blood through the pores of the skin. It could do a lot of damage to soft tissue. And as the little sign said on the door off Harrison, "We treat menstrual suppression electrically." There was the Macintosh galvanic battery. The long leads were hooked up to the battery. The leads had intravaginal and intrauterine attachments on insulated rubber-covered handles. That way the abortionist wouldn't feel the shock in his hands. When Mrs. Eames's daughter died, before Dr. Larch could operate on her, and without her having further words with him, beyond the shit-or-get-off-the-pot note that was pinned to her shoulder, her temperature was nearly 107. The house officer felt compelled to ask Larch if he knew the woman. The note certainly implied an intimate message. "She was angry with me for not giving her an abortion," Wilbur Larch replied. "Good for you," said the house officer. But Wilbur Larch failed to see how this was good for anyone. There was a widespread inflammation of the membranes and viscera of the abdominal cavity. The uterus had been perforated twice, and the fetus, which was dead, was true to Mrs. Eames's daughter's prediction. It had not been quick. In the morning, Dr. Larch visited off Harrison. He needed to see for himself what happened there. He wanted to know where women went when doctors turned them down. On his mind was Mrs. Eames's daughter's last puff of cigar breath in his face as he bent over her before she died, reminding him, of course, of the night he needed her puffing cigar to find his clothes. If pride was a sin, thought Dr. Larch, the greatest sin was moral pride. He had slept with someone's mother and dressed himself in the light of her daughter's cigar. He could quite comfortably abstain from having sex for the rest of his life, but how could he ever condemn another person for having sex? The German choir blasted him at the door with a little sign that promised the return of menstruation electrically. There was a harsh and out-of-tune piano, no oboe, no English horn, no mezzo-soprano. Yet Larch thought the music was remindful of Mahler's Kindertotenlieder. Years later, when he first heard the scream-concealing sound of the water rushing through Three-Mile Falls, he would remember the abortionists' songs that pumped like jism off Harrison. He beat on the door. He could have screamed, but no one heard him. When he opened the door and stepped inside, no one bothered to look at him. The German choir kept singing. The only instrument was a piano, and there was not nearly enough chairs for the women, and there were only a few music stands. The men stood huddled in two groups, far from the women. There weren't enough copies of the sheet music to go around. The choir conductor stood by the piano. A lean, bald man without a shirt, he wore a dirty white shirt collar, perhaps to catch the sweat, and kept his eyes half-closed, as if in prayer, while his arms wildly pummeled the air, as if the air, which was full of cigar smoke and the urine-like stink of cheap draft beer, were hard to move. The choir pursued the man's wild arms. A fussy or critical god, thought Wilbur Larch, would strike us all dead. Larch walked behind the piano and through the only open door. He entered into a room with nothing in it, not a piece of furniture, not a window. There was only a closed door. Larch opened it and found himself in what was obviously the waiting room. At least, people appeared to be waiting there. There were even newspapers and fresh flowers and an open window. Four people sat in pairs. No one read the papers or sniffed the flowers or looked out the window. Everyone looked down and continued to look down when Wilbur Larch walked in. At a desk, with only a pad of paper and a cash box on it, sat an alert man eating something that looked like navy beans out of a bowl. The man appeared young and strong and indifferent. He wore a pair of work overalls and a sleeveless undershirt. Around his neck, like a gym instructor's whistle, hung a key, obviously to the cash box. He was as bald as the choir conductor. Larch considered that their heads were shaved. Without looking at Wilbur Larch, the man, who might have been one of the choir sitting out a song or two, said, "Hey, you don't come here. You just have the lady come by herself or with a lady friend." In the front room, Wilbur Larch heard them singing something about someone's dear mother. Wasn't that what Mutterlein meant? "I'm a doctor," Dr. Larch said. The cash box man kept eating, but he looked up at Larch. The singers took a deep breath, and in the split-second silence, Larch heard the man's swift, skillful spoon scrape against the bowl, and from another room, the sound of someone retching, quickly followed by the splash of vomit in a metal basin. One of the women in the waiting room began to cry, but before Larch could identify which of the women it was, the singers caught their breath and bore down again. Something about Christ's blood, Larch thought. "What do you want?" the man asked Larch. "I'm a doctor. I want to see the doctor here," Larch said. "No doctor here," the man said. "Just you." "Then I want to give advice," Larch said. "Medical advice. Free medical advice." The man studied Larch's face. He appeared to think that a response to Larch's offer could be found there. "You're not the first one here," the man said after a while. "You wait your turn." That seemed to satisfy both men for the moment, and Larch looked for a seat, taking a chair precisely between the twosomes of women already in the room. He was too shocked by everything to be surprised when he recognized one of the couples. The Lithuanian woman whose child he'd delivered, his first delivery, sat mutely with her mole-faced mother. They wouldn't look up at him. Larch smiled at them and nodded. The woman was very pregnant. Too pregnant for an easy abortion under the safest of circumstances. Larch realized with panic that he couldn't convey this to her. She spoke only Lithuanian. She would associate him with delivering only live babies. Also, he knew nothing of what might have become of her first baby, nothing of what her life with that baby had been or was now. He tapped his foot nervously and looked at the other couple, also, clearly, a mother and her daughter. But both of them were younger than the Lithuanians, and it was hard to tell which of them was pregnant. This abortion, at least, looked easier to perform. The daughter looked too young to be pregnant, but then why, Larch wondered, had the mother brought the girl here? Did she need the company so badly, or was this meant as a lesson? Watch out, this could happen to you. In the front room, the singers grew hysterical on the subject of God's love and something that sounded like blinding destiny. Verblendenden Geschicke. Wilbur Larch stared at the shut door, behind which he had heard unmistakable vomiting. A bee, crazily out of place, buzzed in the open window and seemed to find the flowers fakes. It buzzed straight out again. When Larch looked at the Lithuanian couple, he saw that the grandmother had recognized him, and she had discovered a new way to exhibit her mole, which had grown additional and longer hairs and had slightly changed color. Pinching her fingers to either side of the mole, the grandmother inflamed the surrounding skin and made the mole appear to explode from her face, like a boil come to a head, about to burst. The pregnant woman seemed not to notice her mother's charmless demonstration, and when she stared at Larch, she appeared not to recognize him. For Larch, there was only Lithuanian written on her face. Perhaps, Larch thought, her husband threw her baby out the window and drove her mad. For a moment, Larch thought that the choir might be Lithuanian, but he recognized something about a battle between Gott und Schicksal. Clearly German, clearly God and fate. The scream that cut through the shut door had no difficulty rising above the voices declaring that God had won. The young girl jumped from her seat, sat down, hugged herself, cried out. She put her face in her mother's lap to muffle her cries. Larch realized she'd been the one to cry before. He also realized that she must be the one needing the abortion, not her mother. The girl didn't look older than 10 or 12. "Excuse me," Larch said to the mother. "I'm a doctor." He felt like an actor with good potential who'd been crippled with a single stupid line. It was all he had to say. "I'm a doctor." What followed from that? "So you're a doctor," the mother said bitterly. But Larch was happy to hear she didn't speak Lithuanian. "So what help are you?" the mother asked him. "How many months is she?" Larch asked the mother. "Maybe 3. The mother said suspiciously, "but I already paid them here." "How old is she?" Larch asked. The girl looked up from her mother's lap, a strand of her dirty blonde hair caught in her mouth. "I'm 14, she said defensively. "She'll be 14 next year," the mother said. Larch stood up and said to the man with a cash box key, "Pay them back, I'll help the girl." "I thought you came for advice," the man said. "To give it," Dr. Larch said. "Why not take some while you're here?" the man said. "When you pay, there's a deposit. You don't get a deposit back." "How much is the deposit?" Larch asked. The man shrugged. He drummed his fingers on the cash box. "Maybe half," he said. "Jure ganze Macht," the choir sang. "Your whole power," translated Wilbur Larch. Many medical students were good in German. When the evil door opened, an old couple, like someone's bewildered grandparents, peered anxiously into the waiting room, both confusion and curiosity on their faces, which, like the faces of many old couples, had grown to resemble each other. They were small and stooped, and behind them, on a cot, as still as a painting, a woman lay resting under a sheet, her eyes open but unfocused. The vomit basin had been placed on a towel on the floor within her reach. "He says he's a doctor," the cash box man said, without looking at the old couple. "He says he came to give you free medical advice. He says to pay these ladies back. He says he'll take care of the young lady himself." By the way that the old white-haired woman had become a presence, or stronger, a force, in the doorway between the waiting room and the operating theater, Larch realized that she was in charge. The old white-haired man was her assistant. The old woman would have looked at home in a pleasant kitchen, baking cookies, inviting the neighborhood children to come and go as they please. "Dr. Larch," Dr. Larch said, bowing a little too formally. "Oh, yes, Dr. Larch," the old woman said, neutrally. "Come to shit or to get off the pot?" The abortionist was known in the neighborhood off Harrison as Mrs. Santa Claus. She was not the original author of that remark, or of that note. Mrs. Eames's daughter had written that herself before she went to see Mrs. Santa Claus. She knew enough about the dangers off Harrison to know that she might be in no shape to ride anything at all after Mrs. Santa Claus finished with her. Larch was unprepared for Mrs. Santa Claus, specifically for her attitude. He had imagined that in any meeting with an abortionist, he, Dr. Larch, would take charge. He still tried to. He walked into the operating theater and picked up something just to demonstrate his authority. What he picked up was the suction cup with a short hose running to the foot pump. The cup neatly fitted into the palm of his hand. He had no trouble imagining what else it fitted. To his surprise, when he had attached the cup to his palm, Mrs. Santa Claus began stepping on the foot pump. When he felt the blood rushing to his pores, he popped the cup out of his palm before the thing could raise more than a blood blister on the heel of his hand.
"Well?" Mrs. Claus asked aggressively. "What's your advice, doctor?"
As if in reply, the patient under the sheet drew Larch to her. The woman's forehead was clammy with sweat.
"You don't know what you're doing," Dr. Larch said to Mrs. Santa Claus.
"At least I'm doing something," the old woman said with hostile calm.
"If you know how to do it, why don't you do it?" Mrs. Santa Claus asked.
"If you know how, why don't you teach me?"
The woman under the sheet looked groggy, but she was trying to pull herself together. She sat up and tried to examine herself. She discovered that, under the sheet, she still wore her own dress. This knowledge appeared to relax her.
"Please listen to me," Dr. Larch said to her. "If you have a fever, if you have more than just a little bleeding, you must come to the hospital. Don't wait."
"I thought the advice was for me," Mrs. Santa Claus said. "Where's my advice?"
Larch tried to ignore her. He went out to the waiting room and told the mother with her young daughter that they should leave, but the mother was concerned about the money.
"Pay them back," Mrs. Santa Claus told the cash box man.
"They don't get the deposit back," the man said again.
"Pay them back the deposit, too,"
the old woman said angrily. She came into the waiting room to oversee the disgruntled transaction. She put her hand on Dr. Larch's arm.
"Ask her who the father is," Mrs. Santa Claus said.
"That's none of my business," Larch said.
"You're right," the old woman said. "That much you got right. But ask her anyway. It's an interesting story."
Larch tried to ignore her. Mrs. Santa Claus grabbed hold of both the mother and her daughter. She spoke to the mother.
"Tell him who the father is," she said.
The daughter began to snivel and whine. Mrs. Santa Claus ignored her. She only looked at the mother.
"Tell him,"
she repeated.
"My husband," the woman murmured.
And then she added, as if it weren't clear,
"Her father."
"Her father is the father," Mrs. Santa Claus said to Dr. Larch. "Got it?"
"Yes, I've got it, thank you," Dr. Larch said. He needed to put his arm around the 13-year-old who was sagging. She had her eyes shut.
"Maybe a third of the young ones are like her," Mrs. Santa Claus told Larch nastily.
She treated him as if he were the father.
"About a third of them get it from their fathers, or their brothers. Rape," Mrs. Santa Claus said. "Incest. You understand?"
"Yes, thank you," Larch said, pulling the girl with him, tugging the sleeve of the mother's coat to make her follow.
"Shit her, get off the pot," Mrs. Santa Claus yelled after them. "All you starving doctors," the cash box man hollered. "You're all over."
The choir was singing. Larch thought he heard them say,
"Vom keinen Sturm erschrecket," frightened by no storm.
In the empty room that separated the songs from the abortions, Larch and the mother with her daughter collided with the woman who'd been under the sheet. She was still groggy, her eyes were darting, and her dress was plastered with sweat to her back.
"Please remember," Larch said to her, "if there's a fever, if there's more than a little blood."
Then he saw the woman's underwear pinned to the shoulder of her dress. That reminding epaulette was the badge of Off Harrison, a kind of ribbon for bravery. Obviously, the woman didn't know that her panties were there. Larch imagined that the South End was sprinkled liberally with these staggering women, their panties pinned to their shoulders, marking them as indelibly as that long-ago Puritan New England A upon their bosoms.
"Wait,"
Dr. Larch cried, and grabbed for the underwear. The woman didn't want to wait. As she pulled herself free of his grasp, the pin opened and stuck Larch in the hand. After she'd gone, he put her panties in his suit jacket pocket. He led the mother and her daughter through the room that was always so heady with song. But the choir was taking a beer break. The lean, bald conductor had just dipped into his frothy stein when he looked up and saw Dr. Larch leaving with the women. A mustache of foam whitened his lip, and a dab of the white froth shone on the end of his nose. The conductor raised his stein toward Dr. Larch, offering a toast.
"Praise the Lord," the conductor called. "You keep on saving those poor souls, Doc."
"Dankeschön,"
the choir called after him. Of course, they could not have been singing Mahler's Songs on the Death of Children, but those were the songs Wilbur Larch had heard. In other parts of the world, wrote Dr. Wilbur Larch upon his arrival in St. Cloud, an ability to act before you think, but to act nonetheless correctly, is essential. Perhaps there will be more time to think here in St. Cloud's. In Boston, he meant he was a hero, and he wouldn't have lasted long being a hero. He took the young girl and her mother to the South Branch. He instructed the house officer to write up the following. "This is a 13-year-old girl. Her pelvis is only 3.5 inches in diameter. Two previous violent deliveries have lacerated her soft parts and left her with a mass of unyielding scar tissue. This is her third pregnancy as a result of incest, as a result of rape. If allowed to come to term, she can be delivered only by cesarean section, which, given the child's delicate state of health, she is a child, not to mention her state of mind, would be dangerous. Therefore, I've decided to give her an abortion."
"You have?" the house officer asked.
"That's right," Wilbur Larch said. And to the nurse anesthesiologist he said, "We'll do it immediately." The abortion took only 20 minutes. Larch's light touch with ether was the envy of his colleagues. He used the set of dilators with the Douglas points in both a medium-sized and a small curette. There was, of course, no mass of unyielding scar tissue. There were no lacerated soft parts. This was a first, not a third pregnancy, and although she was a small girl, her pelvis was certainly greater than 3.5 inches in diameter. These fictional details, which Wilbur Larch provided for the house officer, were intended to make the house officer's report more convincing. No one at the Boston Lying-In ever questioned Larch's decision to perform this abortion. No one ever mentioned it, but Dr. Larch could tell that something had changed. He detected the dying of conversations upon his entering a room. He detected a general aloofness. Although he was not exactly shunned, he was never invited. He dined alone at a nearby German restaurant. He ate pig knuckles and sauerkraut, and one night he drank a beer. It reminded him of his father. It was Wilbur Larch's first and last beer. At this time in his life, Wilbur Larch seemed destined to a first and last existence. One sexual experience, one beer, one abortion. But he'd had more than one experience with ether, and the news in the South End that there was an alternative to Mrs. Santa Claus and the methods practiced off Harrison traveled fast. He was first approached while standing in a fruit vendor's cart, drinking fresh-squeezed orange juice. A tall, gaunt woman with a shopping bag and a laundry basket materialized beside him.
"I ain't quick," the woman whispered to Wilbur Larch. "What's it cost? I ain't quick, I swear."
After her, they followed him everywhere. Sleepily, at the South Branch, he was always saying to one colleague or another,
"It's not my turn, is it?"
And always the answer was the same.
"She says you're her doctor."
A child of Maine, Wilbur Larch was used to looking into people's faces and finding their eyes. Now he looked down, or away. Like a city person, he made their eyes hunt for his. In the same mail with his catalogue of surgical instruments from Fred Halsam and Company, he received a copy of Mrs. W. H. Maxwell's A Female Physician to the Ladies of the United States. Until late in 1870-something, Mrs. Maxwell had operated a woman's clinic in New York. "The authoress has not established her hospital simply for the benefit of lying in women," she wrote. "She believes that in the view of the uncharitableness of general society towards the erring, it is fit that the unfortunate should have some sanctuary to which to flee, in whose shade they may have undisturbed opportunity to reflect, and, hiding forever their present unhappiness, nerve themselves to be wiser in the future. The true physician's soul cannot be too broad and gentle." Of course, Wilbur Larch saw that the South End was mercilessly full of evidence of uncharitableness towards the erring, and that he had become, in the view of the erring, the sanctuary to which to flee. Instead, he fled. He went home to Maine. He applied to the Maine State Board of Medical Examiners for a useful position in obstetrics. While they sought a position for him in some developing community, they liked his Harvard degree and made him a member of their board. Wilbur Larch awaited his new appointment in his old hometown of Portland, that safe harbor, the old mayor's mansion where he had spent the half-life of his childhood, the salty boarding house where he had caught his dose of life from Mrs. Eames. He wondered if he would miss the South End. The palmist who had assured him he would live a long time and have many children, too many to count, which Larch understood as confirmation that, in seeking to become an obstetrician, he had made the right choice. The fortune-teller who had told young Larch that he would never follow in his father's footsteps, which was all right with Wilbur Larch, who had no knowledge of lathes, no fondness for drink, and was sure that his liver wouldn't be the culprit of his final undoing. And the Chinese herb doctor who had told Larch that he could cure the clap by applying crushed green leaves and bread mold to his penis. The quack was almost right. The chlorophyll in the plants would destroy the bacteria that contributed to gangrene, but it wouldn't kill the dance couples in the pus cells, those lively gonococci. The penicillin, extracted from some bread molds, would. Years later, Larch would dream that if only Dr. Harold Ernst, Harvard Medical School's bacteriologist and curveball pitcher, and the Chinese herb doctor from the South End had put their heads together, well, what wouldn't they have cured? "They would not have cured orphans," wrote Dr. Larch when he woke from that dream. And the orphans of the South End, Wilbur Larch remembered them from the branch hospitals of the Boston Lying In. In 1890-something, less than half the mothers were married. In the institution's charter, it was written that no patient would be admitted unless a married woman or one recently widowed and known to be of good moral character. The benevolent citizen groups who had first contributed thousands of dollars to provide for a lying-in hospital for the poor, they had insisted. But in truth, almost everyone was admitted. There was an astonishing number of women claiming to be widows or claiming marriage to sailors off to sea. Gone with the Great Eastern, Wilbur Larch used to imagine. In Portland, he wondered, why were there no orphans, no children or women in need? Wilbur Larch did not feel of much use in the tidy town of Portland. It is ironic to think that while he waited to be sent somewhere where he was needed, a prostitute's letter about abandoned women and orphans was making its way to him from St. Cloud's. But before the letter arrived, Wilbur Larch had another invitation. The pleasure of his company was requested by a Mrs. Channing Peabody of the Boston Channing Peabodys, who spent every summer on their coastal property just east of Portland. The invitation suggested that perhaps young Larch missed the Boston society to which he'd doubtlessly become accustomed and would enjoy some tennis or croquet, or even some sailing, before a dinner with the Channing Peabodys and friends. Larch had been accustomed to no Boston society. He associated the Channing Peabodys with Cambridge or with Beacon Hill, where he was never invited. And although he knew that Channing and Peabody were old Boston family names, he was unfamiliar with this strange coupling of the two. For all Wilbur Larch knew about this level of society, the Channings and the Peabodys might be throwing a party together, and for the purpose of the invitation had agreed to hyphenate their names. As for sailing, Wilbur Larch had never been on the water, or in it. A child of Maine, he knew better than to learn to swim in that water. The Maine water, in Wilbur Larch's opinion, was for summer people and lobsters. And as for tennis or croquet, he didn't own the proper clothing. From a watercolor of some strange lawn games, he had once imagined that striking a wooden ball with a wooden mallet as hard as he could would be rewarding, but he wanted time to practice this art alone and unobserved. He regretted the expense of hiring a driver to take him to the Channing Peabody summer house, and he felt uncomfortably dressed for the season. His only suit was a dark, heavy one, and he hadn't worn it since the day of his visit off Harrison. As he lifted the big brass door knocker of the Channing Peabody house, choosing to introduce himself formally rather than wandering among the people in their whites at play at various sports around the grounds, he felt the suit was not only too hot but also needed a pressing. And he discovered in the jacket pocket the panties of the woman who had aborted the birth of her child off Harrison. Wilbur Larch was holding the panties in his hand and staring at them, remembering their valiant epaulette position, their jaunty bravery on the woman's shoulder, when Mrs. Channing Peabody opened the door to receive him. He could not return the panties to his jacket pocket quickly enough, so he stuffed them into the pocket in the attitude of a handkerchief he'd just been caught blowing his nose in. By the quick way Mrs. Channing Peabody looked away from them, Larch knew she'd seen the panties for what they were, women's underdrawers, plain as day. "Dr. Larch," Mrs. Channing Peabody said cautiously, as if the panties had provided her with a clue to Dr. Larch's identity. "I should simply leave now," Wilbur Larch thought, but he said, "Yes, Dr. Larch," and bowed to the woman, a great gunship of a woman with a tanned face and a head helmeted in silver-gray hair, as sleek and as dangerous-looking as a bullet. "You must come meet my daughter," the woman said. "And all the rest of us," she added with a booming laugh that chilled the sweat on Wilbur Larch's back. All the rest of them seemed to be named Channing or Peabody or Channing Peabody, and some of them had first names that resembled last names. There was a Cabot and a Chadwick and a Loring and an Emerald, who had the dullest brown eyes. But the daughter whom Mrs. Channing Peabody had designated to meet Dr. Larch was the plainest and youngest and least healthy-looking of the bunch. Her name was Missy. "Missy?" Wilbur Larch repeated. The girl nodded and shrugged. They were seated at a long table, next to each other. Across from them, and about their age, was one of the young men in tennis whites, either the Chadwick or the Cabot. He looked cross, or else he just had a fight with Miss Channing Peabody, or else he would rather have been seated next to her himself. Or maybe he's just her brother and wishes he were seated farther away from her, thought Wilbur Larch. The girl looked unwell. In a family of tans, she was pale. She picked at her food. It was one of those dinners where the arrival of each course caused a complete change of dishes, and as the conversation lapsed and failed, or at least grew fainter, the sound of china and silverware grew louder, and a tension mounted at the dinner table. It was not a tension caused by any subject of conversation. It was a tension caused by no subject of conversation. The rather senile, retired surgeon who was seated on Wilbur's other side—he was either a Channing or a Peabody—seemed disappointed to learn that Larch was an obstetrician. Still, the old codger insisted on knowing Dr. Larch's preferred method of expelling the placenta into the lower genital tract. Wilbur Larch tried quietly to describe the expression of placenta to Dr. Peabody, or Dr. Channing, or whoever he was, but the old man was hard of hearing and insisted that young Larch speak up. Their conversation, which was the dinner table's only conversation, thus progressed to injuries to the perineum, including the method of holding back the baby's head to prevent a perineal tear, and the proper mediolateral incision for the performance of an episiotomy when a tear of the perineum seems imminent. Wilbur Larch was aware that Missy Channing Peabody's skin was changing color beside him. She went from milk to mustard to spring grass green, and almost back to milk before she fainted. Her skin was quite cool and clammy, and when Wilbur Larch looked at her, he saw that her eyes were almost completely rolled up into her head. Her mother and the cross young man in tennis whites, the Cabot or the Chadwick, whisked her away from the table. "She needs air," Mrs. Channing Peabody announced, but air was not in short supply in Maine. Wilbur Larch already knew what Missy needed. She needed an abortion. It came to him through the visible anger of young Chadwick or Cabot. It came to him over the babbling senility of the old surgeon inquiring about modern obstetrical procedure. It came to him through the absence of other conversation and through the noise of the knives and the forks and the plates. That was why he'd been invited. Missy Channing Peabody, suffering from morning sickness, needed an abortion. Rich people needed them, too. Even rich people who, in Wilbur Larch's opinion, were the last to learn about anything. Even rich people knew about him. He wanted to leave, but now it was his fate that held him. Sometimes when we are labeled, when we are branded, our brand becomes our calling. Wilbur Larch felt himself called. The letter from the prostitute from St. Cloud's was on its way to him, and he would go there. But first he was being called to perform. Here. He rose from the table. The men were being sent to some special room, for cigars. The women had gathered around someone's baby. A nurse or a governess, a servant, thought Wilbur Larch, had brought a baby into the dining room, and the women were having a look. Wilbur Larch had a look, too. The women made room for him. The baby was rosy-looking and cheerful, about 3 months old. But Dr. Larch noticed the forceps mark on its cheek. A definite indentation, it would leave a scar. I can do better work than this, he thought. Isn't that a darling baby, Dr. Larch? One of the women asked him. It's too bad about that forceps mark, Larch said, and that shut them all up. Mrs. Channing Peabody took him out into the hall. He let her lead him to the room that had been prepared for him. On the way, she said, We have this little problem. How many months along is she? He asked Mrs. Channing Peabody. Is she quick? Quick or not, Missy Channing Peabody had certainly been prepared. The family had converted a small reading room into an operating theater. There were old pictures of men in uniform, and books, looking long untouched, stood at attention. In the grim room's foreground was a solid table appropriately set with cotton batting and rubber sheeting, and Missy herself was lying in the correct examining position. She was already shaved, already swabbed with the bichloride solution. Someone had done the necessary homework. Perhaps they'd pumped the senile family surgeon for details. Dr. Larch saw the alcohol, the green soap, the nail brush, which he proceeded immediately to use. There was a set of 6 metal dilators and a set of 3 curettes in a leather-covered, satin-lined case. There was chloroform and a chloroform inhaler, and this one mistake, that they didn't know Wilbur Larch's preference for ether, made Larch almost forgive them. What Wilbur Larch could not forgive was the obvious loathing they felt for him. There was an old woman in attendance, perhaps some faithful household servant who had played midwife to countless little Channing Peabodys, maybe even midwife to Missy. The old woman was particularly chisel-faced and sharp-eyed when she looked at Larch, as if she expected him to congratulate her, at which moment she would not acknowledge that he'd spoken to her, for her precision in readying the patient. Mrs. Channing Peabody herself seemed unable to touch him. She did offer to hold his coat, which he let her take before he asked her to leave. "Send that young man," Larch told her. "He should be here, I think." He meant the particularly hostile young man in tennis whites, whether he was the outraged brother or the guilty lover, or both. "These people need me, but they hate me," Larch was thinking, as he scrubbed under his nails. While he let his arms soak in the alcohol bath, he wondered how many doctors the Channing Peabodys must know. How many must be in the family? But they would never have asked one of their kind for help with this little problem. They were too pure for it. "You want my help?" the sullen young man asked Larch. "Not really," Larch replied. "Don't touch anything and stand to my left. Just look over my shoulder and be sure you can see everything." That class-conscious look of scorn had all but left young Chadwick's or young Cabot's face when Wilbur Larch went to work with the curette. With the first appearance of the products of conception, the young man's expression opened. That certain judgmental air was not discernible in any aspect of his face, which seemed softened and resembled his tennis whites in its color. "I have made this observation about the wall of the uterus," Dr. Large told the ghostly young man. "It is a good, hard, muscular wall, and when you've scraped it clean, it responds with a gritty sound. That's how you know when you've got all of it, all the products of conception. You just listen for that gritty sound." He scraped some more. "Can you hear it?" he asked. "No," the young man whispered. "Well, perhaps sound isn't the right word," Wilbur Larch said. "Perhaps it's more like a gritty feeling, but it's a sound to me." "Gritty," he said, as young Cabot or young Chadwick attempted to catch his own vomit in his cupped hands. "Take her temperature every hour," Larch told the rigid servant who held the sterile towels. "If there's more than a little bleeding, or if she has a fever, I should be called. And treat her like a princess," Wilbur Larch told the old woman and the ashen, empty young man. "No one should be allowed to make her feel ashamed." He would have departed like a gentleman after he looked under Missy's eyelids at her chloroform gaze. But when he put his coat on, he felt the envelope bulge in the breast pocket. He didn't count the money, but he saw there were several $100. It was the mayor's mansion all over again, the servants' quarters treatment. It meant the Channing Peabodys wouldn't ask him back for tennis or croquet or a sale. He promptly handed about $50 to the old woman who had bathed Missy's genitals with the bichloride solution and had covered her with a sterile vulval pad. He gave about $20 to the young tennis player who had opened the door to the patio to breathe a little of the garden air. Larch was going to leave. Then, when he shoved his hands in his coat pockets and found the panties again, on an impulse he grabbed the placenta forceps and took the instrument with him. He went off looking for the old surgeon, but there were only servants in the dining room, still clearing the table. He gave each of them about $20 or $30. He found the senile doctor asleep in a reading chair in another room. He opened the mouth of the forceps, clamped the pair of panties from Off Harrison in it, and then clamped the whole business to the old snorer's lapel. He found the kitchen, and several servants busy in it, and gave away about $200 there. He went out on the grounds and gave the last of the money, another $200, to a gardener who was on his knees in a flower bed by the main door. He would have liked to have handed the empty envelope back to Mrs. Channing Peabody. The grand lady was hiding from him. He tried to fold the envelope and pin it to the main door under the big brass door knocker. The envelope kept blowing free in the wind. Then he got angry and wadded it up in a ball and threw it into a manicured circle of green lawn, which served as a rotary for the main driveway. Two croquet players on a far lawn held up their game and stared first at the crumpled envelope and then at the blue summer sky, as if a lightning bolt, at the very least, were momentarily expected to strike Larch dead. On his way back to Portland, Wilbur Larch reflected on the last century of medical history, when abortion was legal, when many more complex procedures than a simple abortion were routinely taught medical students, such things as utero decapitation and fetal pulverization, those in lieu of the more dangerous cesarean section. He mumbled those words to himself, utero decapitation, fetal pulverization. By the time he got back to Portland, he had worked the matter out. He was an obstetrician. He delivered babies into the world. His colleagues called this the Lord's work. And he was an abortionist. He delivered mothers, too. His colleagues called this the devil's work, but it was all the Lord's work to Wilbur Larch. As Mrs. Maxwell had observed, the true physician's soul cannot be too broad and gentle. Later, when he would have occasion to doubt himself, he would force himself to remember. He had slept with someone's mother and dressed himself in the light of her daughter's cigar. He could quite comfortably abstain from having sex for the rest of his life, but how could he ever condemn another person for having sex? He would remember, too, what he hadn't done for Mrs. Eames's daughter, and what that had caused. He would deliver babies. He would deliver mothers, too. In Portland, a letter from St. Cloud's awaited him. When the Maine State Board of Medical Examiners sent him to St. Cloud's, They could not have known Wilbur Larch's feeling for orphans, nor could they have known his readiness to leave Portland, that safe harbor from which the Great Eastern had sailed with no plans for return. And they would never know that in the first week Wilbur Larch spent in St. Clouds, he founded an orphanage, because it was needed, delivered three babies, one wanted, two inevitable, one would be another orphan, and performed one abortion, his third. It would take Larch some years to educate the population regarding birth control. The ratio would endure for some time, one abortion for every three births. Over the years it would go to one in four, then one in five. During World War I, when Wilbur Larch went to France, the replacement physician at the orphanage would not perform abortions. The birth rate would climb, the number of orphans would double, but the replacement physician said to Nurse Edna and to Nurse Angela that he was put on this earth to do the Lord's work, not the devil's. This feeble distinction would later prove useful to Nurse Angela and to Nurse Edna, and to Dr. Wilbur Larch, who wrote his good nurses from France that he had seen the real devil's work. The devil worked with shell and grenade fragments, with shrapnel and with the little dirty bits of clothing carried with a missile into a wound. The devil's work was gas bacillus infection, that scourge of the First World War. Wilbur Larch would never forget how it crackled to the touch. "Tell him," Larch wrote Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, "tell that fool," he meant his replacement, "that the work at the orphanage is all the Lord's work. Everything you do for the orphans. You deliver them." And when the war was over and Wilbur Larch came home to St. Clouds, Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela were already familiar with the proper language for the work of St. Clouds. The Lord's work and the devil's work, they called it, just to keep it straight between themselves which operation was being performed when. Wilbur Larch went along with it. It was useful language. But both nurses were in agreement with Larch that it was all the Lord's work that they were performing. It was not until 1930-something that they encountered their first problem. His name was Homer Wells. He went out into the world and came back to St. Clouds so many times that it was necessary to put him to work. By the time a boy is a teenager, he should be of use. But would he understand? The nurses and Dr. Larch wondered. Homer had seen the mothers come and go and leave their babies behind, but how long before he started counting heads and realized that there were more mothers coming and going than there were babies left behind? How long before he observed that not all the mothers who came to St. Clouds were visibly pregnant, and some of them didn't even stay overnight? Should they tell him? The nurses and Dr. Larch wondered. "Wilbur," Nurse Edna said, while Nurse Angela rolled her eyes, "the boy has the run of the place. He's going to figure it out for himself." "He's growing older every minute," Nurse Angela said. "He's learning something new every day." It was true that they never let the women recovering from the abortions rest in the same room with the new mothers, who were gaining their strength to leave their babies behind. That was something even a child could observe. And Homer Wells was frequently in charge of emptying the waste baskets. All the waste baskets, even the operating room waste baskets, which were leak-proof and taken directly to the incinerator. "What if he looks in a waste basket, Wilbur?" Nurse Edna asked Dr. Larch.
"If he's old enough to look, he's old enough to learn," St. Larch replied.
Perhaps Larch meant if he's old enough to recognize what there was to be seen. After the Lord's work, or after the devil's, much that would be in the waste basket would be the same. In most cases, blood and mucus, cotton and gauze, placenta and pubic hair. Both nurses told Dr. Larch there was no need to shave a patient for an abortion, but Larch was fussy. And if it was all the Lord's work, he thought, let it all look the same. The waste baskets that Homer Wells would carry to the incinerator held the history of St. Clouds. The clipped ends of the silk and gut sutures, fecal matter and soap suds from the enemas, and what Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela feared Homer Wells would see, the so-called products of conception, a human fetus, or a recognizable part thereof. And that is how Homer Wells, an unlucky 13, would discover that both the quick and the not quick were delivered at St. Clouds. One day, walking back from the incinerator, he saw a fetus on the ground. It had fallen from the wastebasket he'd been carrying, but when he saw it, he assumed it had fallen from the sky. He bent over it, then he looked for the nest it might have dropped from. Only there were no trees. Homer Wells knew that birds didn't deliver their eggs in flight, or that an egg, while falling, couldn't lose its shell. Then he imagined that some animal had miscarried. In an orphanage around a hospital, one heard that word. But what animal? It weighed less than a pound, it was maybe 8 inches long, and that shadow on its almost translucent head was the first phase of hair, not feathers. And those were almost eyebrows on its scrunched face. It had eyelashes, too. And were those nipples, those little pale pink dots emerging on that chest the size of a large thumb? And those slivers at the fingertips and at the toes, those were nails. Holding the whole thing in one hand, Homer ran with it straight to Dr. Larch. Larch was sitting at the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. He was writing a letter to the New England Home for Little Wanderers. "I found something," Homer Wells said. He held out his hand, and Larch took the fetus from him and placed it on a clean white piece of typing paper on Nurse Angela's desk. It was about 3 months, at the most 4. Not quite quick, Dr. Larch knew, but almost. "What is it?" Homer Wells asked. "The Lord's work," said Wilbur Larch, that saint of St. Clouds, because that was when he realized that this was also the Lord's work, teaching Homer Wells, telling him everything, making sure he learned right from wrong. It was a lot of work, the Lord's work, but if one was going to be presumptuous enough to undertake it, one had to do it perfectly. Chapter 3. Princes of Maine, Kings of New England. "Here in St. Clouds," Dr. Larch wrote, "we treat orphans as if they came from royal families." In the boys' division, this sentiment informed his nightly blessing, his benediction shouted over the beds standing in rows in the darkness. Dr. Larch's blessing followed the bedtime reading, which, after the unfortunate accident to the Winkles, became the responsibility of Homer Wells. Dr. Larch wanted to give Homer more confidence. When Homer told Dr. Larch how he had loved reading to the Winkles in their safari tent, and how he thought he had done it well, except that the Winkles had fallen asleep, the doctor decided that the boy's talent should be encouraged. In 1930-something, almost immediately after seeing his first fetus, Homer Wells began reading David Copperfield to the boys' division, just 20 minutes a crack, no more, no less. He thought it would take him longer to read it than it took Dickens to write it. Faltering at first, and teased by the very few boys who were near his own age, no boy was older, Homer improved. Every night he would murmur aloud to himself that book's opening passage. It had the effect of a litany. On occasion, it allowed him to sleep peacefully. "Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show." "Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life," Homer whispered to himself. He remembered the dryness in his eyes and nose in the furnace room at the Drapers in Waterville. He remembered the spray from the water that had swept the Winkles away. He remembered the cool, damp, curled in on itself beginning that lay dead in his hand. That thing he had held in his hand could not have been a hero. And after lights out, and Nurse Edna or Nurse Angela had asked if anyone wanted a last glass of water, or if anyone needed a last trip to the potty, when those dots of light from the just-extinguished lamps still blinked in the darkness, and every orphan's mind was either sleeping, dreaming, or lingering with David Copperfield's adventures, Dr. Larch would open the door from the hall, with its exposed pipes and its hospital colors. "Good night," he would call. "Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England." That thing Homer had held in his hand was no prince. It hadn't lived to be a king. Then, bang, the door would close, and the orphans would be left in a new blackness. Whatever image of royalty that they could conjure would be left to them. What princes and kings could they have seen? What futures were possible for them to dream of? What royal foster families would greet them in sleep? What princesses would love them? What queens would they marry? And when would they escape the darkness left with them after Larch closed the door, after they could no longer hear the retreating squeaks of Nurse Edna's and Nurse Angela's shoes?